And like I said, my name is Doug Smith, and I'm with the Agricultural Research Service in West Lafayette, Indiana. I've heard experimentalists, including myself, complain about the uncertainty in modeling. And I've heard quite a few modelers say that they do not receive enough information about uncertainty from measured data. We couple these together, and we know that environmental policy has to be made on the most sound science possible. But there's a dichotomy between science and policy. I took this from a paper by Bradshaw and Borchers, and it lists, you know, in science, we accept a hypothesis based on a certain probability. But in policy, typically they want some level of certainty. In science, we know that inequality is the fact, but in policy, they cannot deal very easily with inequality, so there has to be some equality. So you go through this list of different items, and there's a difference in how us as scientists view the world and how policymakers and legislators view the world. Policy implementation can cost millions or even billions of dollars. So as scientists, how do we proceed in advising when there's such great uncertainty behind some of our estimates when we know there's this much money involved? An example is the 2002 Farm Bill. The conservation spending in that bill accounted for $13 for every resident in the United States, and the Office of Management and Budget required NRCS to provide some type of accounting for that expenditure. So NRCS came to ARS and to the universities and developed a project called SEAP, Conservation Effects Assessment Project, to try to help them develop this cost-benefit analysis. It's easy for NRCS to say, yeah, we're putting grass waterways out on the landscape and we know that we're doing great things, but the only measure that they have that they can use as their documentation is some type of a Russell 2 estimate or something similar to that, but they needed something more definitive. Recently, about a year ago, a report by the Treasury Department said that new taxes on cap and trade would be between $100 billion and $200 billion. And this was going to account for roughly an $1,800 per year per household tax increase. So whenever the government and taxpayers are concerned about $13 over the life of a bill per resident, you can just imagine the type of questions that will be raised whenever there's this type of investment by the American taxpayer. So how should we advise science, or how should scientists advise public and policy with uncertainty? We know that uncertainty increases with the scale, the complexity, and the heterogeneity of different systems. So, for example, in watershed modeling, if I have my 5-acre field, I can do some tremendous things with modeling of that 5-acre field. I move out to a 1,000-acre watershed. There's so much more complexity, so much more, so many different processes involved in that scale that your uncertainty increases. You move out to a 12-digit huck, an 8-digit huck, with each level, there's greater scale and greater uncertainty in the processes involved in nutrient transport, hydrology, what have you. Look at complexity, toxicity studies. Rufus can tell you quite a bit about toxicity studies. Quite a few of those deal with one organism and one substance. Maybe it's some particular fish species with atrazine. So there's a limited number of variables there to discuss. But you move out to much more complex systems like global climate models, and you talk about biogeochemical systems on a much larger scale. You talk about hydrologic cycles, you talk about ocean currents, you talk about meteorological systems. You increase by many orders of magnitude the number of variables, and with each one of those variables, there's uncertainty. So you've increased the uncertainty by many orders of magnitude when we look at global climate models compared to toxicity studies. And then you talk about heterogeneity. Philip Owens, who's one of our later presenters, can talk to you about heterogeneity in soils. We all know as soil scientists how we handle that, going from very small studies and trying to make implications across a landscape. Skepticism can be a major problem whenever we offer up uncertainty. The public trusts so-called scientific consensus. So you look at this graph by Bradshaw and Borchers. As we develop a hypothesis and increase our replication or confirmation of that scientific process, we as a scientific community gain trust in that hypothesis. And it's not until this scientific consensus is reached that the public starts to gain acceptance and understanding of that. However, we can cause great damage to that if we completely leave out of the discussion any type of uncertainty, and then somewhere during this volition phase, there's a sudden input of uncertainty into the mix. I think the things that went on at just before last Christmas with East Anglia is kind of good evidence of that. Look at different types of uncertainty that can come into play. Models are often developed for a specific application. However, whenever we apply the model to something that it's not meant to do, there's uncertainty there that people can ignore. For example, if we develop a model for sheet and rill erosion and then apply it to systems with gully erosion, that's not a good application of that model. Model components are often adapted from previous versions of models, and we can have two levels of uncertainty entering into the mix there. For example, one is there's a model that my lab used for water quality. They adapted some components from a previous model, and there were some incompatibilities in the code. So the values for pesticide transport that we were getting were three orders of magnitude too low. And it was due to some coding problems and some miscommunication between the modeling teams about how to make certain changes there. We also have some potential for updated science. We're working with a model now that, as I understand it, was originally the components of the model were originally made in the late 70s and early 80s. That was folded up and pushed into a second model, and then that second model was folded up and pushed into a third model. So some of that science that was developed 25, 30 years ago may not contain the most current information that we have. And then we know that consultants can be in plug and chug mode, where they have to apply a model to get an answer for a report that's due tomorrow. We have a colleague that was a consultant in a former life, and I've heard him say that he tried his best to find answers when he had to do his modeling, but if he couldn't find an answer, he just put in a number that looked right. So there's uncertainty whenever we apply these models, and we're basing decisions on those. Modelers want uncertainty about the data that they input. I was at a meeting about 5 years ago when there was a major call from the modelers for experimentalists to place these uncertainty estimates, and there was quite a bit of grumbling from the experimentalists, trying to dismiss it as nonsense. But if we just look at sample analysis, whenever I inject a sample into my ICP, I accept that value if my standard is plus or minus 10% that's run with those. So there, we have to realize as experimentalists that we have uncertainty. Look at how we've developed the phosphorus index. It was developed as a tool to help producers guide their manure applications. It was developed independently by each state, and it's been picked up by regulators and others as an enforcement tool. And that's causing some issues that many people in this room can talk to you in much greater detail than I can. Look at inferences from data to what their implications are across the landscape. This is some data from Heidelberg University on dissolved phosphorus and total phosphorus entering Western Lake Erie from the Maumee River. And from 1975 to 1995, there's a decreasing trend in that data. After that time, there's an increasing trend. The total phosphorus does not show the same trend. They related that to no tillage. But we've had many other changes in agriculture since then that are also possible culprits. Fields equipment, field size, fertilization strategies, applying fertilizers every 3 years instead of every year. And then there's the case of the California Air Resources Board trying to put fuel standards, and they've used a model with some outdated data known as GREET. When the National Biodiesel Board tried to put, try to figure out why biodiesel was getting such a poor rating, they used some data from the National Oilseed Processors Association on processing of soybeans, and that improved these data estimates by 40%. The National Biodiesel Board put in some of their data on biodiesel processing. It increased the score another 50%. And then the Iowa Soybean Association had some information on soybean production and energy usage, and that increased the score another 37%. But since there was uncertainty around that from the Iowa Soybean Association, because it was limited to one state that has not yet been accepted it, and they have a project to collect data from many states. So uncertainty is reality. How do we convey that? We need to work better between modelers and experimentalists, and also between the scientific community and the public. And it's my belief that we absolutely have to have this as a part of the discussion. So, thank you. Okay. Darren tells me I have 2 minutes for questions. Selective bias. You have a very good point. There can be selective bias. For example, when certain models are met, they want to be either too farmer friendly or too policy friendly, so they can bias their own modeling for their personal biases. So that's a very good point. And I think that can cause some real mistrust issues, and it's probably a big part of the mistrust between farming groups and environmental groups. Okay. Yes, sir.
The question is why? I'm from a geological survey in Denmark, and we've been involved in a new European finance project helping policymakers to recognize uncertainty and develop the guidance documents for helping them, for instance, recognizing what's the uncertainty in the data, what's the uncertainty in your models, and they can use that. For instance, they can say, okay, well, the model is a certain factor. I can perhaps invest some money in collecting more data to make my model predictions more reliable. But also, one of the major projects developed concepts of adaptive management, because sometimes uncertainty cannot really deal with, so you need to develop very versatile and flexible measures. So you, in the process of water management, you can adapt to uncertain situations and conditions. You can test and adapt in time to, and make your information more certain. So this requires in fact, it's required by European legislation to provide